When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. Our number, 404-872-0750. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter, at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. So there's been a lot of news over the last couple of weeks, and we've been talking about it. Chief among, I think, the big pieces of news is that the economy actually fell into contraction. It declined 1% over the first quarter. This is on the second estimate. The first estimate was just a slight positive at 0.10%, 0.10 of an increase. But in turn, now they're saying it's a 1% decrease in economic output. And who knows what's going to happen on the third revision. Maybe that'll fall further. So I thought it would be a good idea to kind of see where the housing market is. And I've asked Dr. Lawrence Yun. He's the chief economist and senior vice president of research at the National Association of Realtors to join us this morning. And he really oversees just a huge, everything numbers, everything related to numbers. And I've known Dr. Yun for a very, very long time, and it's a great honor to have you on the show. Dr. Yun, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So when you and I were together maybe at the end of January at the New England Association of Realtors Conference, was that end of January?
Yes, it was at the New England Patriots Stadium, I recall.
Right, which was way cool, actually. I remember, you know, my talk came after yours, and I remember watching your slideshow as you were putting it on your PowerPoint, and you were talking about how you felt that sales were kind of falling off a cliff in some ways, and that you thought that mortgage interest rates would head up over 5% by the end of 2014. And here we are, it's been about 3-4 months since then, and we've seen, in truth, real estate activity decline precipitously, but surprisingly, mortgage interest rates have turned the other way and are now back around 4% for a 30-year fixed-rate loan. I saw one quote below, like at 3.99%. So I thought maybe we could talk for a few minutes about what is going on with the economy and how this has impacted real estate.
Well, mortgage rates dropping, that certainly is a surprise, is a positive surprise for many of the consumers because, you know, they can now refinance. Some people who are right on the margin, who cannot get into the market, but perhaps at lower rate, they can enter the market. So it is a positive news, but that positive news on the mortgage rate is coming due to the fact that the economy is slowing. In the first quarter, actual contraction. Now, some of the contraction are due to temporary factors. Housing sales have been falling. Housing start was weak, and therefore it actually helped contract the GDP numbers. But there's also some temporary factors that cannot be sustained, things like inventory adjustment without going into technicalities, which means that the second and third quarter or second half of the year, the economy will be expanding reasonably, but the year as a whole, it is still a same old story of about 2% GDP growth, and that is just insufficient after a recession. So it's moving in the right direction, but not so strongly.
So I keep hearing about how the dreadful winter, which just affected every part of the country, had a big deal to do with the fact that we contracted. And yet, and I know I read the stories about the inventory adjustment, but and it does feel to me that the economy is back picking up some steam, and yet we've seen the same story for the last 5 years, only usually in the winter it's stronger and then it dies off in the spring. So this year it's kind of reversed. But to your point, 2% growth is very, very weak, no?
So historical GDP expansion should be closer to 3%, and after a recession, it should be 4 or 5% just to compensate for the downturn. But because of this sluggish expansion that we have encountered in the past 5 years, So it's a 5 straight years of sluggish expansion. According to a calculation that I did, it translates into about $4,000 lower income for average Americans across the country. So in other words, if we had, we did not encounter a recession, or put it this way, if we did have a recession, but we came out much stronger expansion, people on average would have $4,000 additional annual income, but we don't have that because of this sluggish expansion.
So when I think about what this means for average people, right, and you know, certainly our listeners in the greater Atlanta area, which is still suffering so much from a housing crisis, you know, it seems to me that they must feel, people must feel they're really not making progress. And I know when people don't feel like they're making progress, they're really not out there buying homes. And if you look at what is making up homes, it's like the first-time buyer market is just kind of, they're out to lunch altogether. That group is maybe half as strong as it should be. You've got investor interest starting to die down as prices have gone up. So they're almost too high now for investors to get in and make some easy money. They're being more cautious. And regular buyers don't have a lot to choose from, which at least is one big explanation for why people are, you know, not buying houses. What else are you seeing out there? What are you hearing from realtors around the country when they talk about the problems that they're having with buyers and sellers?
It's a mixed picture regarding the real estate, how the real estate activity has panned out over the past couple of years. Broadly speaking, we have seen recovery, rising home sales, even though during this winter it actually dropped. It dropped far more than the normal winter activity would suggest. So there was a weakness in sales activity, but prices continue to run up because we are seeing a drawdown in the inventory situation. So with fewer properties on the market, that is continuing to push up prices. Atlanta market, interestingly, is one of the areas who's seeing a more faster recovery in prices, roughly 25% price growth in the past couple of years. So people who bought in recent years, they are doing well. But the problem is it declined so much during the downturn that even 25% recovery doesn't feel like a recovery for people who bought at the top of the market. So there's still a long way to go. But you rightly point out that the first-time buyers are not in the market, which is leading to a very interesting situation where you are seeing price growth, but many of the younger people are not participating in this housing wealth recovery. And investors who came into the market a couple of years ago, they are getting all this wealth recovery in housing. So we have a very mixed picture regarding housing as to who are winners, who are losers. Not everyone is participating. So it's a mixed bag right now.
What does that mean going forward for this generation of first-time buyers who literally, now we're at 5 or 7 years worth of home buyers who are kind of first-time buyers who are out of the marketplace? We're almost getting to 10 years here.
You know, we need to have a more normal recovery, and what that entails is that first-time buyers participating, which means that you have the normal trade-up chain reaction process. The other part is we need to bring more inventory online, and that requires home builders to be more active. Current housing start activity is about 50% below normal, so there still need to be more aggressive building activity. Now, the builders are indicating that it's hard to get the loans,
right,
construction loans, and the lenders are saying they cannot give out construction loan because of the regulatory requirement or regulatory uncertainty. So there's a lot of blame game going on as to why we have lack of inventory. But the reality is we have lack of inventory, so the prices are going up. Prices are going up. It's pricing out some of the first-time buyers. And also stringent underwriting standards is also hindering many young people.
So let's talk about that for just a minute, because I hear a lot of realtors complaining about the stringent underwriting standards, but there were basically no underwriting standards in the early aughts, 2002, 2003, and we had pay option arms, and we had all kinds of crazy loans where people who were earning $50,000 a year were getting approved for $500,000 loans with no doc loans. And so you've really seen the pendulum swung sort of the other way. There really has to be some agreement, I think, among realtors and banks and regulators that people actually have to be able to afford their mortgages to qualify, right? I mean, we don't really want to sell houses to people who can't afford to pay for them.
Yeah, we never want to have this repeat of bubble and crash situation with very lax underwriting standards. But you pointed out that the pendulum completely swung the other way. So rather than trying to get us to the middle ground, what has happened is that from no underwriting standards to now overly stringent. And when I say overly stringent, one can clearly see by the credit score requirements. The Fannie and Freddie mortgages, historically, if someone was in the 720 credit score, that would have qualified to get a Fannie and Freddie-backed mortgages. And for FHA, credit score being a little lower, that would have qualified. But now it is substantially higher, and hence you have, in my calculation, about 15% of the people who could enter the market being shut out at the moment. So pendulum has swung the other way. Another testimony of that is that the mortgage default rates are at historic low, not normal default rate. I mean, generally, we don't want to have default rate, but we understand the nature of the dynamic economy we have. Some people lose jobs. Some people have unexpected hospital bills and so forth. So there's always some element of risk, but the default rates are so low, that is implying that that pendulum has completely swung too much the other way.
Interesting. All right. Well, we have 1 minute left. Any last words about where you think the housing market's going to go later this year?
So from a consumer's perspective, one has to look at the mortgage rates, which is to say that the Federal Reserve is indicating they will be raising mortgage rates. So when one sees this surprise low rates, I think people should try to take advantage of it. The other part is that even though we did have a GDP contraction, jobs are still being created, and the GDP is likely to turn solidly positive in the second half, which means job creation will continue. So there will be a steady flow of pent-up demand coming to the market. We just hope that supply can match up with that demand.
So you don't think we're going to get into an official recession, which would be 2 quarters of negative growth?
I don't think that would be the case. There were some temporary factors, so GDP will be expanding, but it will be a sluggish expansion.
All right. Well, Dr. Lawrence Young, thank you so much for being with me today and giving us all the benefit of your deep knowledge and insight into this. Dr. Young is the Chief Economist and Senior Vice President of Research for the National Association of Realtors. If you go to the thinklink.com blog at thinklink.com, we will put up links to his Economist Outlook blogs over at realtor.org. Dr. Young, I'll see you soon, I hope.
Thanks for having me on the show.
All right. Stay tuned, everybody. We'll be back in a moment with more of the Elise Klink Show, Rebuilding America One House at a Time, starting with yours on WSB.
Monday at Atlanta's Morning News, new developments in the Cooper Harris hot car murder case, the crisis of the U.S. border, and the chance of showers leading up to the cold snap next week. That's right, a cold snap in July. And you start the new week Monday with WSB.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Klink Show, Rebuilding America One House at a Time, starting with yours on WSB. 404-872-0750. I wanted to just follow up with what Lawrence Young was saying. So he doesn't believe that we're going to see 2 quarters of contraction. And I know I talked about this last week, but I don't know. I'm thinking the second quarter of this year might still show something close to zero growth. If we then move into a little bit higher momentum, let's just say, right, we might end up with 2 to 3% for the third and fourth quarters, and that would give us an average of about 1.5%. This is so low, folks. I just can't even stress it strongly enough. When you're at a 2%, you know, anemic is 2%. I don't know, below 2%, you're getting into almost a standstill as far as the economy goes. And as for all these jobs being created, we are seeing jobs created, which is a really good thing, but remember, there's still like 8 or 10 million people who have just left the workforce because there were no jobs for them, or they could work part-time but not full-time, and they really wanted to work full-time. And then there are a whole group of people who got new jobs, but they're paying less than they were making before. And so when you think about an economy's purchasing power, you really have to think about what people have in their very own pockets. Think about what's in your pocket and what your take-home pay is. And are you making more today than you were eight or 9 years ago? Are you making more than you were making 5 years ago? If you're not, and your take-home pay is the same, you've technically lost money because you're actually have had, and there is inflation, even though that's low too, there's inflation that's kind of moving up as well. So just something to keep in mind as you're out there looking around. It's a very unusual economic situation right now, and it's deeply affecting the real estate market. And coming up next, we're going to hear a little bit more about this with Rick Sharga, who's the executive vice president of Auction.com. Google just made a $50 million investment in them, and we'll hear why. Coming up next on the Elyse Glink Show, Rebuilding America, One House at a Time, starting with yours on WSB. Welcome back, everybody, to the Elyse Glink Show, Rebuilding America, One House at a Time, starting with yours on WSB. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter, at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. And if you're looking for the Intentional Investor Series, go to thinklinkstore.com, thinklinkstore.com. We are still offering our big discount. Just use the code BUY now and get 80% off, B-U-Y-N-O-W. Rick Sharga joins me on the line. He's the executive vice president of Auction.com, and he functions as the company's chief spokesperson on all things relating to the U.S. housing market, mortgage market, commercial real estate, and international real estate market. And Auction.com, you may sound familiar to you. Google just invested something like $50 million into them, and they've sold $25 billion, with a B, billion dollars worth of real estate since 2007. Rick, welcome back to the program.
Always nice to talk to you, Elyse.
Oh, thanks. Nice to have you here. So we just had Lawrence Yun on, and we were talking about how the first quarter was such a disappointment. I mean, the revised number is perfectly awful, a contraction of 1%, and the next revision could even be a little bit worse than that. And yet he seems to feel optimistic about the rest of the year, that we're going to end up maybe with an anemic 1.5% to 2%, which must mean that the rest of the year is going to go gangbusters. But he does admit that first-time buyers are kind of out of the marketplace, and it's just super slow, and builders aren't building enough. And I don't know, we didn't get any answers there. What do you? I know you focus a lot on millennials, first-time buyers, investors. What are you guys seeing from your vantage point?
Well, we're seeing on the first-time home buyer market that these folks are staying out of the market in droves. It's a problem in that the millennials, who should be making up most of the first-time buyer cohort, are forming households much more slowly than anyone had forecast. And when they form a household, they're much more likely to rent than previous generations have been.
Right.
So, you know, we're of the opinion that household home ownership rates are actually going to continue to decline for another year or two before they bottom out, and we start to see buying activity begin to accelerate. But this is all driven by how difficult it's been for that particular age group to recover from the Great Recession. They're just not getting jobs that afford them the opportunity to become a homeowner.
Right. So it's interesting. We have, just in my own office, we've got 12 people, all of whom fall into that category. And a couple of them have bought, but those are the older ones, the ones who are like 30 and are more established and are married. I'm finding the unmarried ones are not out there buying independently anymore, and that they are renting, or parents are buying property and they're moving into those as renters. And there definitely seems to be very little interest around the mid-20s to anything that would even closely approach kind of a long-term purchase decision. And I wonder, and we've talked about this a lot on the show, and you know other experts have weighed in, whether this is really a permanent change, that this group of 10-year millennials, right, because we're already about 7 years out from the end of the recession, and now you've probably got another 2-3 years of this. It's a 10-year period where millions of people just are not buying a house.
Yeah, I you're absolutely right in terms of the timing, and this has been a much longer trough than a lot of people would have expected. But let me give you two perspectives on this. We've seen research from several firms, including Fannie Mae, that suggest this age group still wants to be homeowners at about the same rates as previous generations have. They've just opted to put off the time period when they begin to buy. So the desire still seems to be there. So I don't really think this is a permanent shift back to a renter society. But I do think there are some fundamental reasons that they're having trouble and have decided to delay. This generation has a much higher amount of student loan debt than previous first-time home buyer mm-hmm. groups did. There are much more stringent lending practices in place right now, among other things that would make that debt that they're carrying, that would make it virtually impossible for them to qualify for a lot of the loan products that are out there. They have not recovered from a jobs perspective from the recession. A lot of them have service jobs or temporary positions and really don't want to take on the burden of a long-term financial commitment knowing that their jobs are tenuous.
Right.
Between not qualifying for a loan and not having a down payment available, which is the number one reason they cite for not purchasing, I think this is really financially driven. There's a little bit of psychology in this as well, but I don't think it's a permanent shift in homebuyer mentality.
So that's kind of interesting. The only point I would make there is that if you've got a 10-year swath, it's a little like the first home is going to disappear for them. So
yes.
What would be the move-up second home will become the first home at a lower price point. Does that make sense to you?
It absolutely does. And what you didn't say there is also pretty important for the housing market, because there are a whole cohort of homeowners out there right now who won't be able to move up themselves
right.
because there's nobody coming to buy their house.
Right.
And so I've been sort of on the bearish side in terms of demand.
Mm-hmm.
I was out last year saying I didn't see the market exceeding the number of homes we sold in 2013, and you know, we had some realtors and audiences ready to throw things at me. But
I'm surprised they didn't throw things at me.
but I just didn't see where the demand was going to come from. And between that relatively weak economic recovery in this buying group, and the fact that to a certain extent investor activity is slowing down a little bit. We're clearly going to end the year this year with fewer home sales than we did a year ago.
Yeah. It's interesting because you're seeing this is supposed to be the strongest market right now. I mean, we're in the spring, and if houses don't sell in the spring, like, what does that mean for the rest of the year? I don't see it picking up dramatically in summer. So now we're into the fall, and, okay, maybe a few more people will buy, but if they're feeling kind of poor from what's been going on the first half of the year, I'm not so sure it's going to pick up there as well.
Affordability is an issue, and
mm-hmm.
and people forget the third leg of the stool. People focus on interest rates going up and down, and they're still at historically low levels, and people focus on home prices going up. But in most markets in the country, they're still way below peak, 20-25% below peak. The third leg of the stool that people forget about is wages, and for most people in the middle class, wage growth has either been negative or flat for the last probably 5 to 10 years. So even marginal increases in home prices or interest rates make affordability a challenge. So what we really need are the creation of more full-time, good-paying jobs in order to get people to a position where they really can afford these homes.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I've been saying for my entire career, basically, that jobs are tied directly to real estate, and if you don't have a good job, you're really not going to go out and buy a house that's going to require monthly maintenance and assessment costs and, you know, insurance and all kinds of other things, and, oh, hello, a monthly mortgage payment. It's just not going to happen.
No.
So, looking at, now I know that auction.com also deals in commercial property sales, and you do a lot of work with investors.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on in the commercial world?
Well, actually, the commercial market is for the most part, and I'm speaking in generalities here, it's doing pretty well, and it's recovering nicely. Now, that's uneven from a geographic standpoint, and it's also a little bit uneven in various commercial segments. For example, retail is still fairly weak.
Mm-hmm.
Hospitality, on the other hand, is doing rather nicely right now. So you're seeing different types of investor activity, both in terms of construction and in terms of resales. But by and large, the commercial market has certainly bottomed out and begun to come back in a pretty meaningful way.
So that's really amazing because, of course, 3-4 years ago, boy, I mean, you could not give away buildings.
No.
People were completely freaked out as everybody was going out of business and small businesses were closing and malls were being vacant. I remember driving through Arizona, block after block after block, and they were saying, oh, do you like our see-through community, where you literally could see the front and the back windows and there was nothing in between for block after block after block of these retail shopping malls.
Well, retail probably is one of the segments that's still relatively weak compared to the others. Not surprisingly to you or your listeners, multifamily is going gangbusters,
right.
both from a development and a sales perspective. So, you know, I hate to keep hammering back on the same subject, but if you take a look at job growth and job development, not surprisingly, things like office space are doing much better in markets where you've had employment growth.
Right.
So there is some regionality to this. And the markets that were very hard hit, you know, candidly, commercial, it is probably recovering there a little more slowly than the residential markets did because you didn't have the institutional investor activity coming in and gobbling up a lot of the distressed assets like you did on the residential side.
What do you think? I want to shift gears just a little bit and talk about auction.com for a minute. What do you, aside from having a terrific URL, why do you think that this has been so phenomenally successful? I mean, it's clearly impinging on the roles of realtors, both who do, you know, brokerage, commercial brokerage and on residential. Mm-hmm. But why has this platform just taken off when so many others didn't, do you think?
Let me give you a couple thoughts on that. The first thing I'd like to say is that this will probably surprise you. More than 90% of the properties we sold last year did involve a realtor on at least one side, if not both sides of the deal.
Okay.
So I really see this as being a hybrid model developing over time, where we're working with realtors, with brokers and agents, and not instead of them. Although the platform does lend itself to people that want to do their own for sale by owner sort of activity. Partly I think this is right place, right time. The company, as you mentioned, invested pretty significantly in securing the auction.com URL. I joined the company about a year ago because I believe it's inevitable that people will migrate online to buy and sell real estate. Even though they may view the real estate offline and do their inspections and so forth offline, it's a much less painful process to just go onto a website and click something that says buy.
But for a house, even for an office building, I mean, you know, it could be a little dangerous, right?
We started with distressed properties, mm-hmm. and so you're selling to a lot of investors,
right.
Individual investors, mid-sized companies, and institutions, and there's a little less emotion, a little less fear involved. We do on weekends auctions that are only for owner occupants. And those do reasonably well. But again, you do those in concert with an agent who will do open houses, let people take a look at the properties. And then people actually like the transparent bidding process. They
right.
like the notion that they can see other bids coming online. They know if they're ahead or they're not. And they kind of like that better than the closed envelope approach where they give their best and final offer to a realtor and hope for the best.
Yeah, hope it gets presented, among other things. That once in a while happens as well. Rick, thank you so much for your insights today. Really, really appreciate it.
I always enjoy the conversations, ma'am. Good talking to you.
All right. Be well. Talk to you soon. Stay tuned, everybody. We'll be back in a moment with more of the Elyse Glink Show, Rebuilding America, One House at a Time, starting with yours on WSB.
Check back often for breaking news, weather, and traffic all weekend. This is Scott Slate. We'll check traffic every 6 minutes beginning at 4:30 on Atlanta's Morning News Monday. And the chance of showers leading up to the big change in temperatures next week when you start the new week with WSB.
Everybody. everybody, to the Elise Glynn Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. Next hour, we have a real treat for you. My good friend, Farnoosh Torabi, is going to come on the show. She has just written a new Amazon best-selling book, number one best-selling book, called When She Makes More. And this is a book that talks about what is happening with women who are starting to advance in the workplace, making more money, because even though overall women make less, about 80 cents in the dollar that men make, there are a lot of women now who are the big breadwinners or make more money than their husbands. And this is especially for younger millennial generation type people back in their 20s and 30s. And so she wrote this book because it brings up all kinds of other issues about relationship issues and financial issues, decision issues, control issues. Control, that's an interesting word. So I thought it would be great to have her on the show to talk about all of this and try and get some of the questions answered that I think people have and are wondering when she makes more and what that actually means. So stay tuned for that. It's going to be a great conversation coming up. In the meantime, don't forget to follow me on Twitter at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. And if you're a real estate investor, do not miss this last chance opportunity for the Intentional Investor Series, How to Be Wildly Successful in Real Estate. I'm Elise Glink, and I'll be back in a moment with more of the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB.
When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. So I have a real treat for you right now. My good friend, Farnoosh Torabi, who's a personal finance expert and book author and TV personality, she is on the show to talk about her brand new book. And her book is called When She Makes More, 10 Rules for Breadwinning Women, which I think is such an amazing title. And I have been talking to her. She and I talk often, and so I was with her talking to her along the way. She was writing this book, and she's put so much work into it. I thought it would be great for you to hear some of the research and some things that she discovered along the way of writing this book. Farnoosh, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Elise. I'm so honored to be on your show. And finally, after so many discussions we've had about this, it's come to reality.
Well, it's come to reality, and it's a number one bestseller on Amazon, and it is fantastic. So let's start with the question that I'm sure everybody asks you, which is, why did you write this book?
Great question. Well, two reasons. First reason, this is a personal subject for me. I'm in a marriage where I make more, and ever since I've been dating my husband, I've always been the top earner in the relationship. And in the beginning, it was pretty innocuous. I mean, just between he and I, there wasn't really any issue really to discuss or any complexity that I could foresee. It was more that when we got serious and we're talking marriage and we got engaged, and my mother, in fact, discovered that I was the breadwinner, and she was not happy to hear that. She was very clear about how she felt, and that was that, you know, she was worried that I was going to end up in a marriage where, as the breadwinner, I would be stuck. In other words, you know, being this breadwinner, it's a lot of pressure to bring home that paycheck, whether you're male or female, but when you're the woman, it can turn into a lot of resentment, perhaps, once kids enter the picture and you might feel like you don't have the support. You want to maybe not work as much, but you can't, and you sort of feel like you're compromising more than, you know, the average woman. And I didn't want to hear that, of course. I thought that she was talking 1950s talk to me. But, you know, the reality is, and as I started to really research this and explore this beyond my own relationship, you realize that when she makes more, there are a lot of unique complexities that my mother wasn't too far off from. You know, there is this...
Oh, I hate when mom is right.
Mom was right, I know, that there's actually higher risk for divorce when she makes more, higher risk for infidelity. I did my own survey of over 1,000 women in this country.
Wait, infidelity on which side? Her side or his side?
Well, the study that I point out in the book, it focuses more on the men and says that the higher the more that he is dependent on her for finances and for income, the more likely he is to cheat. But also, the more dependent she is on his income, the less likely she is to cheat. So you can kind of reverse that and think, well, maybe if she's, you know, if she's financially independent and he's not making any money and perhaps they're not talking about it and there's some communication breakdown, emotional issues, that they could, you know, go their different separate ways. So along the way, I also, like I said, I surveyed 1,000 women across the country and discovered that when she makes more, she does feel a lot of stress in terms of how to make it all work, from marriage to money to kids to her own personal fulfillment. And then, you know, interviewing lots and lots and lots of couples, including men, you discover that even the strongest men who are the most, you know, feminist-minded and progressive and very, you know, modern thinking, they, you know, at the end of the day, they're men, and we have biological factors that influence how we feel, how we think, what our needs are, and that goes for women as well. And it wouldn't be uncommon to hear a guy say, you know, sometimes I feel less than, sometimes I feel emasculated, sometimes I feel like I don't know how to really provide for my family because I expected to be the financial breadwinner, and when that's not necessary or not as needed, it can be a little jarring for men. And for women, too. I mean, they sometimes have expressed to me that they have felt resentful or just, you know, stressed out. They feel a little helpless. And they feel alone, too, because, again, another reason I wanted to write this book, Elise, was because we weren't talking about it. It was sort of like, this was a reality, a big trend. You know, now we have almost 1 in 4 women in marriage is making more than their husbands. That's up from, you know, 6% in the 1960s. So this is a real issue facing many, many relationships, but yet no one was talking about it.
So let's think about that for a minute, because it's pretty interesting. I think I would love to know if younger people feel the same things, mm-hmm. younger women as the older women who maybe already have had their kids. And what happens as a relationship changes? I mean, in our marriage, my husband's a real estate attorney, and in the beginning, you know, he made more money, and then I would have odd years where I would sell a book or I would do a radio show or I would do something else, and I would make a little more money, and then he would make more money. And it's, if you look at all the years that we've been together, which is 25 years this August, something I'm very mm-hmm. proud of.
Congrats.
It's thank you. It's kind of broken out sort of equally, but
right.
you know, that these issues aren't issues that I've ever even thought about. I feel very fulfilled, and so does he. But I wonder if that's because we're already through all those hard times and we've had
right.
25 years together mm-hmm. and we've kind of worked it out seamlessly.
I mean, I have interviewed a lot of successful couples for this book to then understand what it takes to ultimately make a marriage work when she is the breadwinner. I mean, it is easiest, of course, when both partners come to the table with this notion that gender expectations don't matter. You know, gender role expectations shouldn't play a part in how we determine who does what in this relationship. And when you kind of look at the marriage as a team effort and that you have a long-term vision about where you want to be, you don't obsess about the fact that, you know, well, my wife's making more now and I'm not making anything or making less and I'm miserable because of this and, you know, I refuse to, you know, look at the bright side or look at, you know, maybe 2 or 3 years from now when circumstances could change. I think when you have sort of a longer-term commitment to your goals as a couple, and if you've been together for a long time, you kind of can put things in perspective, and certainly that helps. But your earlier question was sort of about generations, and I think that for the millennials right now, they're really facing this pretty vividly. I mean, if you look at women under the age of 30 in America, in most major cities, they're out-earning their male counterparts. And so you just look at the dating landscape, the chances are you're going out with a guy and meeting him for the first time and discovering that perhaps you have a more lucrative career or you're more educated in many cases.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that the younger generation is definitely more in touch with this. I think whether you're 25 or 45, again, there are these biological gender-oriented forces at play, and I think it's not just maybe your age, but also how you were raised, too. So you could have been raised with very traditional values and be 25 years old today and expect that as a man you want to be the provider, the financial provider, and that's going to influence, how you might feel in a relationship if you're dating somebody who makes more. And so it's not easy to say that definitely it's going to be easier for the younger generation to adapt. They're definitely, I think, more in the know about this and perhaps a little bit more prepared for this kind of a relationship materializing for them in their future. But even then, I think it can be a little, the transition can be tough. And it's easiest for couples who know that they're going into a relationship with income disparity and she making more. It's hardest for couples where the expectation is not that, he was making more from the beginning and then it flips. That can be, I think, a little bit more challenging.
How do you suggest, in the book you talk about 10 strategies for women who are the breadwinners, how do you suggest women deal with this? And where have you found is the greatest success for women?
Well, you can't go it alone. I think that when you're the breadwinner and you're a woman and you've been raised to perhaps take care of yourself, be independent in so many ways, financial. You have to remember that when you're in a relationship, in a marriage, in a partnership, there's two of you, and that your husband's not going to anticipate you in terms of what you need necessarily. And it's really important for your happiness and for your ability to continue on this path of doing well financially and pursuing your career that your husband or your male partner really understands what you need in terms of support. And I think that in the best relationships I've interviewed, the couples are in constant communication. And the other thing, too, is that they're not resistant to change, that they understand that life changes, the economy changes, and so therefore what their purpose is going to be in the relationship at any given time could change. Just because she's making more today doesn't mean she will always be the breadwinner, and so they have to prepare for that, and they should. And to really look at this kind of a dynamic, while it's new territory for a lot of people, it's a great opportunity to sort of reinvent what it means to be in a relationship and how you're going to take care of each other. I think that's kind of the cool part. I think when I hear from women who say, how can I kind of get over this hump? I might not feel so great about being a breadwinner. It's kind of stressful, and it's not. I don't feel like a woman. These aren't my words. These are actual other people's words. And I say, well, there are a lot of advantages to being a female breadwinner for you and also for your household. One is that if you actually do love your career and you do appreciate the income that you bring in, this is an opportunity for you to continue to pursue that, but at that you still have to get your husband to help you out, and not only just help you out, but to be accountable for big things in your relationship. That's really key in a relationship where she makes more, is that, remember, men still want to provide in a very big way. They want to be the most important person to you in that marriage. And, if they're traditionally thinking that that's going to be bringing home the bacon and then it's not, then that needs to be replaced with something else that's equally as significant to you. And I think as women, this is an opportunity to go to our men and say, I might be bringing home the bacon, but what I could really, what I really need from you that could really change the dynamic of our marriage and make me happy is if you would do X, Y, and Z, and not just help me out with these things, but literally take over these domains, whether it's the finances, the food, the child take, you know, take
care of the kids. There are lots of ways. Farnoosh Torabi is the author of a brand new book called When She Makes More, 10 Rules for Breadwinning Women. A little bit hard to say. It's an Amazon number one bestseller, so you can find it there. You can also see her at farnoosh.tv. And Farnoosh, stick around, would you? We'll come back in just a minute with more of the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America One House at a Time, starting with yours on WSB.
Monday at Atlanta's Morning News, new developments in the Cooper Harris hot car murder case, the crisis of the U.S. border, and the chance showers leading up to the cold snap next week. That's right, a cold snap in July. When you start the new week Monday with WSB.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America One House at a Time, starting with yours. My good friend Farnoosh Torabi is on the line with us. She is the author of a brand new best-selling book called When She Makes More, 10 Rules for Breadwinning Women. Farnoosh, we just have a minute left, literally 1 minute. What is your sort of your parting thought here? What do you want people to take away from this book?
Really, I want people to remember that times are changing, and in a relationship, while we have all this conversation happening right now about leaning into your career, and you know, there's a lot of great momentum happening right now for women in the career space and in the academic world, let's not forget that our relationships are important too, and our relationships matter, and we can't take them for granted, and that you need to lean in to your relationships just as much. At the end of the day, when you look back on your life, you know, you're going to be most excited and most proud, perhaps, of the family that you built and the relationships that you established and nurtured. And I think that too often we easily give up on them because maybe we feel misunderstood. It's not easy. And when she makes more, you might be misunderstood. It might not be easy to be in a relationship like that, but it doesn't mean that it's not fixable. It's not winnable. It absolutely is. And so I just wish that this book will, you know, allow couples and women and men to really talk honestly about their emotions. It might not be politically correct what you're feeling, but do discuss them and be open about that. Because at the end of the day, that's what's going to take you to come to reconcile, you know, with yourself and with your partner.
So true. Thank you. Farnoosh Torabi, go buy the book, guys. Well, you guys should buy it for your women. But ladies, you should buy this as well. When She Makes More, it's at Amazon. We'll put a link up on thinklink.com on the blog today. Farnoosh, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
I'll talk to you soon. Stay tuned. We'll be back in a moment with more of the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America One House at a Time, starting with yours on WSB. Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America One House at a Time, starting with yours on WSB. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. And if you want to follow up with all of our guests today, you can go to the thinkglink.com blog and check out everybody's links and information and follow me on Twitter, of course, at Glink, because we're going to put stuff there too. So we've got a great last person to kind of round things up. Jed Kolko is on the line. He's the chief economist for a fabulous site, Trulia, and he leads housing research there. But he's also had just a tremendous amount of experience looking at numbers in the public sector. So he used to be an associate director of research and a fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California. He's worked with the World Bank, the Office of Federal Housing Enterprise Oversight, all kinds of really interesting places, and it's just given him a great take on where the economy is and how it affects you. Jed, welcome back to the program.
Great to be back. Thanks, Elise.
So let's start with affordability. We've talked a lot today already about how we had this, you know, I think surprise correction, you know, negative growth, 1%. That seems like it hit everybody out of the blue with surprise. Were you surprised by that?
I was surprised. We have seen in previous quarters that the economy has been growing. And of course, jobs and income are critical for where we are in the housing recovery right now. You know, in the past couple of years, some of the housing recovery, the increase in prices, has come from investor interest and others who are buying because homes look cheap. Now, as prices have moved back closer to normal levels, we're depending more on jobs and income for regular families to be buying homes. And if the economy is not growing, it's harder to see that in the housing recovery.
I think that it was Rick Sharga who earlier today said, you know, if everything had been on track the way it normally would be after a recession, the average American family would have about $4,000 more in their pocket today than they do in terms of income. And so to your point, people really aren't earning what they were earning, and they're certainly not always earning enough to pay for a house when you've got an sort of rising prices. Now, here's the surprise, the second surprise. Mortgage interest rates were supposed to be heading upward, and now they've been heading downward again.
That's right. We've been expecting mortgage rates to rise, both because the economy's been recovering and because of the Fed tapering, the Fed cutting back on its bond purchases that had helped keep rates low. Now, the slowdown in the economy goes hand in hand with lower rates. After a recession like the one that we've had, mortgage rates and other interest rates tend to rise as the economy picks up. But we've seen the stall both in the first quarter growth numbers as well as in the slow drift down in interest rates. Interest rates peaked last summer above 4.5, and we haven't quite gotten back up to that level since.
Right. It's been kind of crazy. And in fact, now I've seen numbers below 4%, which is for a 30-year fixed rate loan. The 15-year is hovering a little under 3.5%. Good deals to be had out there if you can find something to buy.
Right. Rates now they still aren't quite as low as they were before mortgage rates spiked. Remember, starting last May, rates started to rise sharply from a low below 3.5, which was the lowest that any of us can remember. Rates are still above that level today. But they have been drifting downward, which has helped a little bit, provided that you can make the down payment, get a mortgage, and find the home that works for you.
It's a lot of ifs, and I wonder if millennials are just not even bothering. And for them, sort of not having good jobs, not making that much money, affordability is even more of an issue. I know you've done some work on the Rent versus Buy blog that you run every now and again. What are you finding for this? Where are you finding those numbers now?
Right now, because mortgage rates are still very low by historical norms. Remember, last decade, even during the bubble, rates were around 6%. So with rates in the low fours right now, it still looks 38% cheaper to buy than to rent on average nationally.
Mm-hmm.
If you stay put for 7 years, itemize your taxes at the 25% tax bracket, and can get a mortgage at today's low rates. That's still a big gap. Even in pricier markets, in the San Francisco Bay Area, in New York, buying still looks cheaper than renting, even though prices have gone up, and that gap has started to narrow. But because mortgage rates are so low compared to historical norms, buying still looks like the better deal if you can swing the down payment and get the mortgage.
Those are two big ifs for millennials, particularly first-time homebuyers who don't have great jobs. You know, finding that extra down payment is kind of tough. I was also hearing from Lawrence Yun earlier today that, you know, 720 used to be, as a credit score, FICO credit score of 720 used to be enough to get you the best rates and points, and now that's gone up to about 760. It's not, you know, a little bit harder to get your credit score up that high. How is that affecting things from your perspective?
It is a challenge for millennials, and right now, the housing recovery is not about first-time homebuyers. Millennials are more likely to be renting,
mm-hmm.
And many of them are now just to the point where they're starting to move out of their parents' homes or out of roommate situations into their own place. But they're going to rent first before they buy.
Right.
It might be several years before they save enough for a down payment and build up an income history to qualify for a mortgage. Until they can become first-time home buyers. So the sales that we're seeing now are increasingly repeat buyers, people who are trading up, down, or across. There's less investor buying because prices have gone up, There's not much first-time buying because the decline in affordability is squeezing those first-timers especially. So the market is more and more about those repeat buyers.
Right, but repeat buyers need somebody to buy their prior residence, right? And first-time buyers are not buying the first home, so those first-time buyers, well, they were first-time buyers, can't move up to be trade-ups. Those trade-ups can't move up. I mean, you really end up with, you know, a chain reaction that is damaging.
Yeah, we've seen sales overall fall off.
Mm-hmm.
Recently. Now, some of that has been a drop in distress sales. You know, as foreclosures work their way through the market, as they get sold off, the inventory of foreclosed homes has gone down in most of the country. So some of that drop in sales reflects fewer foreclosures and short sales. And that's part of the market recovery to work through those remaining foreclosures. When we leave those out, we've seen somewhat of a slowdown in the non-distressed sales, the conventional sales as well, though the broader trend, you know, has been upward over the past few years for those conventional sales. And I expect as prices keep rising, as construction continues to pick up, we will see more inventory coming onto the market.
Well, I hope so, although you have, it's really interesting. I think millennials have another issue, and I'm sure you've looked at this a little bit, which is job jumping. So there's less stability, either because they're getting laid off after a couple of years, or they leave to take a higher paying job, or what they think will be a higher paying job, and then they leave to take another job, or they change careers. And I think you're seeing this kind of hop, skip, and jumping more than you might normally see it in this age bracket, and I do think it's affecting sort of the long-term affordability. You know, when you change jobs, sometimes you make more money, but you do sometimes also lose traction, particularly if you're moving across country or across state lines to take that job. What are you seeing with regards to that? Is that factor, this sort of nervousness about jobs, playing into, do you think, the psychological part of it, of not buying a house?
Yeah, I think for young people, it's a little more fundamental than that. It's about having the job in the first place and an income that can support the mortgage. We are seeing fewer long-distance moves nationally. You know, people are less likely to make moves, to make long-distance moves than they used to be. The way in which that sort of job hopping plays into housing is that unless you're going to stay put for several years, it usually makes more sense to rent.
Mm-hmm.
So someone who is thinking that they might have to move to another city to find a new job 3 or even 5 years from now is going to be a lot less likely to buy than someone who can feel pretty sure that they'll want to be working and living in the same city 7 or 10 years out.
You know, the other thing that's interesting, one of my former employees, who I think is about 29 or 30 now, she bought her first place 2 years ago, and it's interesting. Now she has a boyfriend, right? And so she listened to me, and she bought a two-bedroom place instead of a one-bedroom. But now he just got a job offer in San Jose, your neck of the woods, and they're going to be moving out. And so she said, I went to go and think about trying to sell my place, but there was still one on the market forever, and the realtors are telling me it's only worth about what I paid, so I'd lose money. So I guess I'm going to rent. Rents are very strong in her neighborhood, and so she's finding herself being put into the role of a landlord, which I don't think she expected to be, and she'll be a faraway landlord as well.
Yeah, and that's the position that lots of people, both institutional investors and mom-and-pop investors, have found themselves in.
Mm-hmm.
From the height of the bubble until now, we've added about 4 million rental single-family homes. That's a huge increase,
right,
in the number of single-family homes that have been rented out. Again, some of those are big institutional investors. You know, some are people who might have never expected to be an investor landlord.
Mm-hmm.
But because rents still look pretty high right now compared with prices in many markets, for a lot of people, the math makes sense to do that.
It's interesting. Where do you think we're going the rest of this year?
I think the rest of this year we're going to, first of all, see a lot of new rentals come onto the market.
Right. There's been a lot of multifamily building going on everywhere.
That's right. Last year in 2013, apartment construction hit a 15-year high. And apartments tend to take about a year or a little more to build on average. So that means all those apartment buildings that were started in 2013 will come onto the market as rentals in 2014. So that'll bring some relief to renters who are seeing rents rise in a lot of markets.
Right. I mean, what did Sean Donovan of HUD said the other day, that we're in a rental affordability crisis?
That's right. Rents have been rising even through the recession when prices fell. Rents rose in many markets steadily through those years. And those were years when incomes were stagnating, but the cost of rental housing continued. Remember, the big increase in affordability we saw from the housing bust was about buying, because prices fell so much and mortgage rates fell so much, buying became much more affordable, but renting didn't.
Right.
That's one of the reasons why, when we look at the rent versus buy math, buying now still looks 38% cheaper than renting. Again, if you stay put for 7 years, itemize it 25%.
Right, and there's in plus in this and plus that. Jed Kolko is chief economist and head of analytics for Trulia. Jed, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Lisa.
All right, talk to you soon. Hey, stay tuned, everybody. We're going to take a short break. Be back in a moment with more of the Elyse Kling Show, Rebuilding America, One House at a Time on WSB. Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Elyse Kling Show, Rebuilding America, One House at a Time on WSB. This was a really fun show for me to do. I love talking to really smart people, and I know that you get the benefit of that. So if you want to find out more, all of these people do very successful blogs. Jed Kolko has one up at trends.truliablog.com. You can find him there. He also contributes to Forbes. We will put everybody's kind of name, rank, serial number, blog link, photo, whatever we've got. We'll stick that all up on the thinklink.com blog, so you can go there and check it out. You can also find other links as well on the site. We've had them on before. So we hope that you've enjoyed that part of the show. For all of you who are still looking for the intentional investor, yes, we did extend it. As I announced last week, there were a lot of interest in this. So we still have the 80% off deal. Use the code BUYNOW, BUYNOW, and go to use it at thinklinkstore.com. Not the regular site, thinklinkstore.com. All right, I got to run, and so do you, but I'll be back next week for another edition of the Elyse Kling Show, Rebuilding America, One House at a Time on WSB. Have a great week, everybody.